Expand.
I'm your host, Brooke Seigner, coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. I know you're going to enjoy tonight's program. So glad you could join us. This is where the past meets the future, and here, everything is possible. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you're about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. Now, we might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. The solar wind is a blistering 600 kilometers per second, and the proton count is up to 2.4. And there are three major sunspot clusters on the sun today. A magnetic filament snaking over the sun's northeastern limb erupted on August 18th, yesterday, producing a significant M5.5 class solar flare. This one missed. And there is a major cluster on the other side of the sun coming around the middle of next week. One thing is for sure, this solar maximum is ramping up for the next 18 months. So we're not out of the sun yet. Couple of announcements I want to make. The Wake Up Now conference in Arizona has been canceled. So if you click on the banner, you're only going to get led to their website to sign up for another one that's coming up in later on in the year, early in the spring. The Pythagoras conference is on. Be sure to click on that banner. You get $100 off if you do. It's the Midwest conference. Lots of great speakers. Southern Indiana, gorgeous resort there. And that's a great value. You don't have to fly. You don't have to have a passport. Easy to get to. We don't hardly ever get conferences like that in the Midwest. And I promise you're going to enjoy yourself there. Also wanted to let you know that the Maya 2012 conference, the window is quickly closing for you to be able to sign up for this. I know the economy hasn't treated everybody well, but that's really the perfect reason to get something in your life to help you turn it around. No sense going through the rest of the year in misery and no clue what to do or how to put it together. You might as well go to the conference and learn something powerful that can help you and change your life. Leave all the scarcity behind. The Maya 2012 conference, if you click on the banner at xsquaredradio.com, you will get a great discount. You'll be able to sign up. Hundreds of you have done this, but so far none of you have signed up for the conference, and they're a little concerned. Times are not that bad. I've given you an entire year to get your money together to do this. You got to see yourself there, my friends. They're going to send me the email addresses of all those hundreds of people that clicked on that banner and went in, and I'm going to contact each one of you individually, and we'll talk it over and see what we can do to help. If you want to be part of the program tonight, and we encourage you to do so, our number is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. You can also listen to the program by calling into our conference line, which is 760-569-7676, and then the passcode 192919#. Many of you have this on speed dial already, but in case that you don't and you have a Droid phone, you can go to xsquaredradio.com, go to the left-hand side, and click on the Droid app. That will take you in instantly. If you have a Droid phone, one tap of the app, and you are in to X Squared Radio. Also, many people write me and ask me what to do to get prepared. Well, beside all the things that I've told you in the books that I've written and things that we talk about on this radio program, we also ask you to get some kind of food storage program together, some kind of emergency kit together, because when it hits the fan and they're asking you to pack everything up and get out or get down the road, you don't really want to rely on Federal Emergency Management Administration to get you around. You don't want to wait for that hot lunch. You want to have what you need to have to get by. And that's why we suggest that you invest in food. And that's why we have affiliated with the Food Investor. If you go to xsquaredradio.com and look on the right-hand side, you'll see at the top of the affiliates is the number one, the Food Investor. If you click on that, you will go to their website, and they have special deals just for X Squared Radio listeners. One of the things that we're working up with them is a 72-hour kit that is a very high-value kit. No, it's not just a bunch of MREs. These are nutritious, delicious, non-monosodium glutamate meals that will keep for 30 years. Not only that, you get all kinds of other goodies in that 72-hour kit to make life a little bit less like scraping the bottom of the garbage can if you're out on the street for 3 or 4 days trying to stay out of your house by order of who knows who. Don't be a burden upon FEMA. Take care of yourself. Be self-reliant. There's still time. It's affordable. It's quality. And that's why we suggest investing in food. The Food Investor, xsquaredradio.com. Don't forget. Lots of interesting stories tonight. We always seem to have these ethically questionable activities going on in other countries. We never have anything like that going on in this country, do we? Well, genetically engineered ethical babies is a moral obligation, says Oxford professor. Genetically screening our offspring to make them better people is just responsible parenting, claims an eminent Oxford academic. Wow. It's true. Peter Illingworth, an IVF clinician who worked on the study, said the death rate among babies born after single embryo transfer was just a fraction above the rate of 10 per 1,000 for all births. Professor Julian Savulescu said that creating so-called designer babies could be considered a moral obligation as it makes them grow up into ethically better children. Do you want me to keep reading? Oh, I'm going to. The expert in practical ethics said that we should actively give parents the choice to screen out personality flaws in their children, as it meant they were less than likely to harm themselves and others. The academic, who is also editor-in-chief of the Journal of Medical Ethics, made his comments in an article in the latest edition of Reader's Digest. He explained that we are now in the middle of a genetic revolution and that although screening for all but a few conditions remained illegal, it should be welcomed. He said that science is increasingly discovering that genes have a significant influence on personality, with certain genetic markers in embryo suggesting future characteristics. By screening in and screening out certain genes in the embryos, it should be possible to influence how a child turns out. Let me just add parenthetically that they will be the perfect politically correct child, not willing to rebel or reject the status quo. In the end, he said, that rational design would help lead to a better, more intelligent, and less violent society in the future. Docile, able to accept team orientation, less body fat, more endurance, better looking. Surely trying to ensure that your children have the best or a good enough opportunity for a great life is responsible parenting, wrote Professor Savulescu, the Uehiro Professor in Practical Ethics. So where genetic selection aims to bring out a trait that clearly benefits an individual in society, we should allow parents the choice. To do otherwise is to consign those who come after us to do the ball and chain of our squeamishness and irrationality. Indeed, when it comes to screening out personality flaws such as potential alcoholism, psychopathy, and disposition to violence, you could argue that people have a moral obligation to select ethically better children. They are, after all, less likely to harm themselves and others. If we have the power to intervene in the nature of our offspring rather than consigning them to the natural lottery, then we should. Agree? Disagree? Give me a call, 888-429-5471. Are you happy with the lot that you won? Are you happy with the physical traits and your psychopathy that you have received via the genetics of your parents and grandparents and all the progeny, your ancestors? Are you happy with that? Would you like to change that? Oh, it can be done. You can break the trend with a little chemical help. Interesting stuff. Now, we have had a couple of specials. In fact, the last 6 or 7 weeks, we've been running drone war updates. And I wanted to let you know, those of you that have just tuned in, that next week we have Noel Sharkey coming on the program. Many of you know him already. He is a professor of robotics at Sheffield University. He is somewhat outspoken, has written several articles, one of which I read and contacted him directly, and he agreed to come on the program. There are some aspects to drones that are fascinating, a la Cyberdyne Systems and many science fiction movies that have been put out, which many might argue is just the carpet for the future of real science. But there are also some ethical and perhaps moral questions that go along with drones. Not to be too reminiscent, going back before this life or the next for many of you, but at one time we used to charge across the frozen tundra at one another wearing animal skins, wielding blades made of God knows what, wood, bronze, iron, steel, rapiers, sabers, claymores, and we fought hand to hand in the early morning fog. And you could hear the metal hitting metal. And, of course, the sounds and smells of war up close and personal. And you fought until you got tired. You went back to camp and you ate and drank water and took a nap. And you went back and did it again. And if you were the last man standing, you got to write the history books. The glory of it all. And then weapons began to improve. We got better at launching at a distance. Arrows and spears and trebuchets and all kinds of cannonry that we have employed to lay waste to human flesh, one country against another, one tribe against another, one people against its own country. And now we have progressed to the point where we are somewhat detached from the sounds and smells of war. We have succeeded not only in our psychological operations, but in centuries of training, military tradition. We have learned to break a human being down and then instill him with a patriotism, a blind obedience to follow orders. And although those orders are followed by humans, they are perpetrated on other humans. And in the heat of battle, when adrenaline overcomes common sense, if you survive for the rest of your life, you have to look into the faces of those who lost theirs at your hand. But now we have come to the point where we're using drones. Drones have no feelings. Drones follow orders no matter what. And they see with a cold, glassy eye from the sky, and the image that comes back is a sampling. Oh, it's not 3D. It's not even close-up. Sometimes it's not even in color. And the viewer on the other side has a dehumanized, digitized, sanitized version of his victim in the crosshairs. And when he pulls the trigger, it's just a score. He doesn't go to bed at night and then wake up with his heart pounding out of his chest and sweat dripping off of his face with the face of those whom he has laid to waste haunting him. It doesn't happen. because it's sanitized, it's dehumanized, it's digitized. And so we've been covering the drone wars from a variety of angles, and Noel Sharkey did a great job of writing an article, which we are going to cover next Sunday right here on X Squared Radio. I think that it's important to watch the development. Yes, there is one aspect you can say, gee, these have really neat names, and it's just technology one up on another, which is fine if you're playing a video game. But DARPA has enlisted makers of Big Dog, yeah, that's the name, to construct machines that can think for themselves. That's right. The Department of Defense has awarded a lucrative contract to an engineering and robotics design company to develop and build humanoid robots that can act intelligently without supervision. There's nobody running a joystick. The plan identifies requirements to extend aid to victims of natural or man-made disasters and conduct evacuation operations. Sounds innocuous enough. The robots will operate with supervised autonomy, according to DARPA, and will be able to act intelligently by themselves, making their own decisions if and when direct supervision is not possible. The Pentagon also envisions that the robots will be able to use basic and diverse tools. The primary technical goal of the DRC is to develop ground robots capable of executing complex tasks in dangerous, degraded, human-engineered environments, like radioactivity or gas or fires or even the battlefield. Competitors in the DRC are expected to focus on robots that can use standard tools and equipment commonly available in human environments, ranging from hand tools to vehicles, with an emphasis on adaptability to tools with diverse specifications. Sounds like an interesting brief, doesn't it? Let me go on. The robots are set to be completed by August 9th, 2014, according to the contract. Boston Dynamics has enjoyed a long working relationship with DARPA, during which time it has developed the rather frightening Big Dog. This hydraulic quadruped robot can carry up to 340 pounds, meaning it can be effectively weaponized and recovers its balance even after sliding on ice and snow. The company has also developed the Cheetah. We covered that about a month and a half ago on this program. It's a fast-legged robot, four-footed, that can gallop over anything at speeds of up to 18 miles an hour, uphill. The company also developed Rise, a robot that climbs vertical terrain such as walls, trees, fences, using feet with micro claws to climb on textured surfaces. In addition to a host of other smaller robots, Boston Dynamics is also developing Petman, a robot that simulates human physiology and balances itself as it walks, squats, and does calisthenics. While the Pentagon says the robots are for humanitarian missions, one cannot avoid thinking of the propensity to adapt this kind of military-style technology to other, more aggressive purposes. Indeed, the Pentagon has, in the past, issued a request to contractors to develop teams of robots that can search for, detect, and track non-cooperative humans in pursuit evasion scenarios. Issued in 2008, the request called for a multi-robot pursuit system to be operated by one person. The proposal described the need to develop a hardware suit that would enable a multi-robot team together with a human operator to search for and detect a non-cooperative human subject. Tell me, have you been non-cooperative lately? The main research task will involve determining the movements of the robot team through the environment to maximize the opportunity to find the subject while minimizing the chances of missing the subject. If the operator is an active member of the search team, the software should minimize the chance that the operator may encounter the subject. It is seemingly important to the Pentagon that the operator should not have to come to contact with the person being chased down by the machines. Really? More sanitization, The description continues, the software should maintain awareness of line of sight as well as communication and sensor limits. It will be necessary to determine an appropriate sensor suite that can reliably detect human presence and is suitable for implementation on small robotic platforms. Paul Marks at the New Scientist pointed out such proposals are somewhat concerning because they inevitably will be adapted for domestic purposes such as crowd control. He goes on to ask, how long before we see packs of droids hunting down pesky demonstrators with paralyzing weapons? Or could the packs even be lethally armed? Marks interviewed Steve Wright, an expert on police and military technologies from Leeds Metropolitan University, who commented, the giveaway here is the phrase, a non-cooperative human subject. Yes, we picked up on that as well. What we have here are the beginnings of something designed to enable robots to hunt down humans like a pack of dogs. Once the software is perfected, we can reasonably anticipate that they will become autonomous and become armed. We can also expect such systems to be equipped with human detection and tracking devices, including sensors which detect human breath and the radio waves associated with the human heartbeat. These are technologies already developed. Indeed, noted as phase three on the Pentagon proposal was the desire to have the robots develop to intelligently and autonomously search. Top robotics expert Noel Sharkey, who's going to be on this program in 1 week from today, professor of artificial intelligence and robotics at the University of Sheffield, has previously warned that the world may be sleepwalking into a potentially lethal technocracy and has called for safeguards on such technology to be put into place. Yeah, well, safeguards only work for ethical nations, Mr. Sharkey. He says, if you have an autonomous robot, then it's going to make decisions who to kill, when to kill, and where to kill them. The scary thing is that the reason this has to happen is because of mission complexity, and also so that when there's a problem with communications, you can send a robot in with no communication, and it will decide who to kill. And that is really worrying to me. The professor, who warned that such autonomous weapons could easily be used in the future by law enforcement officials in cities, pointing out that South Korean authorities are already planning to have a fully armed, autonomous robot police force in their cities. DARPA is the bleeding edge research wing of the United States Department of Defense, has revealed that it will spend millions of dollars on a project called, yes, that's right, Avatar. If you've seen the movie of the same, the highest grossing movie of all time, let me put your mind at rest. DARPA isn't looking to genetically engineer blue-skinned aliens that humans can control. In the words of DARPA itself, the Avatar program will work on, quote, interfaces and algorithms to enable a soldier to effectively partner with a semi-autonomous bipedal machine and allow it to act as the soldier's surrogate, close quote. In other words, DARPA wants to develop the walking equivalent of an unarmed aerial vehicle, a bipedal robot drone, where the controlling soldier is hundreds or perhaps thousands of miles away from the war front. If you've been following extreme tech for the last few months, you've probably experienced a sweaty mix of terror and excitement. This Avatar program isn't some pipe dream. We already have the technology to pull it off. Remember Pet Man, the walking, kneeling, push-up-ing bipedal robot created by Boston Dynamics, the same company behind Alpha Dog? Pet Man was advertised as a tool for testing chemical protection clothing. But really, it doesn't take a genius to imagine a weaponized version. Then there's the interface. It's just a joystick and a multi-monitor display. If you really wanted to become one with your robotic avatar, you could use a virtual reality visor and a suit with sensors and actuators. Brain-computer interfaces aren't quite up to the resolution needed, but in the next couple of years, they could be a viable option as well. Really, with this $7 million investment into the Avatar program, DARPA has merely confirmed what we've speculated all along. Robot soldiers are coming. There was simply no way that a robot like Petman would only be used to test clothing if there was a chance that it might save human lives in the field. Oh, what we have done in the name of saving lives. The only saving grace at this point is that DARPA dictates that these robots surrogates must be semi-autonomous and ultimately controlled by humans. In other words, judgment day at the hands of all controlled Cylons isn't upon us yet. So interesting stuff, to be sure. What kind of interest you have, it's hard to tell. But I would enjoy your feedback. 888-429-5471. Excuse me while I take a sip. I have often said on this program, and have been probably the beneficiary of such funding before, that most of the funding that's going into high technology, whether it's faster, more rugged computers or better vision systems or faster sampling systems or recovery times, is being led by, funded by, military programs. Now, it can be said that, well, we're going to get this military funding and we're going to create a better video game or we're going to create a better word processing program. Or we're going to create something that, saves lives in emergency situations when you have a traffic accident. All that is a wonderful spin-off, but you know and I know that the bulk of the money is being spent to accomplish three things. The first two are to kill people and break things, and the other is to make sure that our warfighters are fixed up and put back into the field as quickly as possible. And that's how you win wars. The question, I guess, ultimately is, why have wars? Some of you could answer that if you want to. 888-429-5471. Why do we do that? Why is it? Well, let me ask you a question. What is the difference between peace at the price of victory or peace at the price of cooperation and corroboration? That does not mean compromise. It means that working together toward a common solution. We fought against Vietnam, as did the French, for almost a generation, and now our furniture is made in Vietnam. Don't you think that's a little better solution than delivering wave after wave of B-52s? I think so. I think it makes sense. I think we could be doing that as a planet, learning to live together as earthlings instead of tribes, but that's just me. Some interesting stuff out there on hypersonic flight. Many of you have been watching the story about what almost looked like, you know, the Thunderbirds, not the jets, but the puppet show that used to be on TV back in the late 60s. It uses a revolutionary scramjet engine that allows it to travel at hypersonic speeds. It was dropped this week from a B-52 bomber. The scramjets are air-breathing aircraft because rather than carrying both fuel and oxygen needed to provide acceleration, they carry only hydrogen fuel. And they pull the oxygen needed to burn it from the atmosphere. Air is forced into the front of the engine, and as hydrogen is injected into the airstream at the right mixture, the gases are compressed, causing the temperature to rise and ignition to occur. This generates huge amounts of thrust and enables the jet to travel at speeds far in excess of the 1,350 mile per hour top speed of, say, the Concorde. the craft called the X-51A Wave Rider. Now that is a top-notch name. Is currently being prepared at Edwards Air Force Base in the Mojave Desert. I say currently as though it was earlier in the week. And in this week, it took part in the test. It was attached to a B-52 bomber's wing. It was taken up to 50,000 feet over the Pacific Ocean near Point Mugu. There it was dropped, and the engine didn't fire. That's exactly right. The experimental craft tested from the bottom of a B-52 bomber. Once released, its radical scramjet engines should fire, take it to Mach 6, over 2,000 meters per second. The project is being funded by NASA and the Pentagon, who hope it can be used for military stealth aircraft and, of course, new weapons. As I said before, that's where most of the major funding comes from. Wave Rider program is estimated to cost $140 million, according to globalsecurity.org. It does have a mixed history, with previous tests being aborted after the engine stalled. And we do have an update to it. The unmanned experiment did fail during an attempt to fly at six times the speed of sound. The X-51A Wave Rider was designed to reach Mach 6, which is roughly about 3,600 miles per hour. The Air Force said Wednesday that a faulty control fin prevented it from starting its exotic scramjet engine, and it was lost. No, it didn't slip in between dimensions. It is unfortunate that a problem with the subsystem caused a termination before we could light the scramjet engine, Charlie Brink of the Air Force Research Laboratory at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio said in a statement. The Wave Rider successfully detached from the B-52 and fired the rocket booster as planned. Then its scramjet engine was supposed to take over as it attempted to climb to Mach 6, but that never happened. 15 seconds after separating from the rocket booster, the Wave Rider lost control, preventing a test of the scramjet engine. All of our data showed we had created the right conditions for engine ignition, and we were very hopeful to meet our test objectives, Mr. Brink said. The Pentagon has been testing hypersonic technologies in hopes of delivering strikes around the globe within minutes. It was the latest failure of the Wave Rider program. A test flight last year ended prematurely with an X-15A, or it should be X-51A, trying to restart its engine until it plunged into the Pacific Ocean. During the first flight of an X-51A in 2010, it reached nearly five times the speed of sound for 3 minutes. There's only one X-51A vehicle left. And you remember, I believe it was early this year, there was another craft that they tried to fire up that was going to go something like, I think it was close to 10,000 miles an hour. And it took off. They dropped it. It took off, and they lost it. Now, I don't know if that means it plunged in the Pacific and splatted in the sea, or if it just disappeared. They never did say. I mean, the article was really, really vague. Go back and find it, but I should have for tonight's program. It's just interesting. What they're trying to do is they're trying to make a drone, a very, very fast drone, so that all they really have to do is take a B-52 up to 50,000 feet anywhere in North Dakota, drop the drone, and then it can literally fly halfway around the planet, 10,000, 12,000 miles in a matter of minutes and deliver whatever it's supposed to deliver. Sort of like a very, very fast ICBM, except very targeted. Interesting enough, you know, there are countries out there that you expect great things as far as exploring space. Panama is not one of the countries that you would think would develop something to go into space. Excuse me while I take a sip. Okay, that wasn't a sip. That was a gulp. That's all right. It's my program. Anyway, a Dutch company called Mars One is planning to settle Mars by the year 2023. Folks, it's 2012. We're talking 11 years. By sending people on a one-way rocket ride to the red planet. Would you go? 888-429-5471 if you've ever had thoughts of doing that. And Mars One hopes to turn the entire process into a reality TV show. I hope it doesn't end like you remember when Arnold Schwarzenegger and his demure partner were ejected onto the surface of Mars right before the terraforming machine kicked in. Remember how their eyes were popping out of their head and how their heads were about to explode? I hope it doesn't end like that, although that would make kind of a neat reality program. They say that the only way the mission will be possible is to fund it commercially. And the only business model that they say they believe is currently feasible is the one based on the creation of a global media spectacle around the project. Sound familiar? North Pole Inner Earth Expedition enthusiasts? They hope a worldwide audience would help pick the teams of settlers following their training, observe the trip, and pay for it. The mission is estimated to cost $6 billion. The plan would be to establish a habitable settlement that would receive new astronauts every 2 years. Probably won't if the first group doesn't end well. The group claims that existing technology would make it feasible. Mars One estimates the trip would take 7 months. Mars One says a team has worked on the plan since 2011. Oh, that's a long time. It says it expects millions of people will sign up for a chance to be one of the first four astronauts. Well, you might want to start with those on death row. Mars One says it plans to build a replica base in a desert here on Earth where astronauts will be tested regularly for about 3 months at a time in Mars-like conditions. I'll tell you what, I'll sign up for that one. With the presence of cameras until they leave Earth, they can always back out. They made a movie about this. It was called Gattaca. NASA scientists have also been studying having astronauts make a one-way trip to set up a human colony on Mars or its moons. A NASA team believes it could send a team of astronauts to settle on Mars by 2030. A journey could take between 6 and 9 months. NASA also envisions a one-way trip to Mars since it would be too expensive to fly people back and forth. Instead, the astronauts would establish a colony on the red planet and be sent regular supplies until they could become self-sufficient or until they declare independence. I'm kidding. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. It sounds all very ambitious, but, you know, Mars is 3 months away. The moon is 3 days away. If a rescue mission was deemed necessary, you could get by on your solar-powered oxygenator. You could get by on extracting water from the soil until a rescue ship could arrive to the moon. On Mars, I'm afraid you're on your own. If you think you can survive long-term on the top of Mount Everest, which is about the same oxygen content as what you would consider sea level on Mars, also the same temperature, then I say go for it. But I've almost been there, been to 18,500 feet, and it's a little skinny, folks. I spent 2 weeks, and I was in excellent condition, and I'm telling you, it's a little skinny. Not much going on at that altitude because of the lack of oxygen. You're also exposed to tremendous amounts of shortwave radiation from the sun because you're missing about 3 miles of atmosphere. On Mars, you're going to be exposed to everything the sun is putting out. Of course, you're 50 million miles further away from the sun, so you know, it's obviously a smaller snapshot. But still, there's no protection. There's no magnetosphere to Mars. I would suggest building underground facilities on the moon. Take advantage of one of the old out-of-service volcanic vents that sits on the moon. Build something subsurface so you can withstand all those little salt and pepper-sized meteorite showers that they have. You can stay out of the way of any solar flares that might happen. And you've got plenty of H3 and oxygen and water locked up in the soil. You've got all the raw materials that you need. Once you get the basic materials up there, and you could take a decade delivering raw materials. I mean, a human can carry a 1,200-pound steel beam easily on the moon. Two could carry, 2,000 pounds pretty easily on the moon. It wouldn't take long sending crews up to work 2-3 weeks at a time to build the basic shelters. Once the shelters are built, then you could make longer excursions out of there until you get something constructed. In 5 or 10 years, you could have a small village built subsurface on the moon, and it wouldn't take long to grow from there. By the time 2030 comes around, you could already have a functional moon port that would make a Mars launch much more feasible. Those are just my thoughts. Your thoughts are always welcome here at X Squared Radio, 888-429-5471. I do have a drone war update, though. Engineers at Boeing, you know who Boeing is, and Johns Hopkins University, you know who they are. My brother was chairman of physiology there for well over 10 years. If you got your MD at that school, you went in front of his desk. Hold on. It has been above 90 degrees here in North Carolina for a little better than a month. I am not a tropical person, so I require lots of water. And tonight it's tang, so we're enjoying. Anyway, these two, Boeing and Johns Hopkins, have devised technology that enables drones to function like a swarm of insects that can communicate and carry out tasks together in mid-flight. It's true. Two small Scan Eagle drones made by Boeing subsidiary In-Situ Inc. autonomously conducted searches and communicated information to one another, Boeing said. The team conducted flight tests in Oregon for several days in June and demonstrated that an operator on the ground using only a laptop and a military radio can communicate and can coordinate the drone swarm to carry out a mission. Sort of like the raptors in Jurassic Park. They work their way in communicating with one another. This swarm technology may one day enable warfighters. Remember I used that word earlier? It's only because I've heard it from officials recently in person. Warfighters in battle to request and receive drones much sooner than they can come from ground control stations today. Swarm network technology has the potential to offer more missions at less risk and lower operating costs. Wow, that makes complete sense. Boeing revealed the process on swarm technology at this week's Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International Trade Show. Oh, yeah, there's a drone trade show where hundreds of robot makers have gathered to show off their wares. Do you think that would be a neat trade show to go to? 888-429-5471. It's a little bit like going to GameStop, and you pick up the DVD cover and you look at the excellent art on the surface of it, and you read about how, each character can move and what kind of weapons and what kind of codes and cheats and things like that are out there. It's a little like that, except you're walking down the aisles and you're looking at things that are real. They're steel and aluminum and titanium, and they're jet-powered and they're propeller-powered and they're solar-powered, and they're the best robotics has to offer because that's where the money is. Boeing and Johns Hopkins did not provide video of how the swarm worked. I'll bet not. The University of Pennsylvania has also tested drone swarm technology, and it has posted video. Watch the video footage below, but you can't see it because you're only listening. But also in Las Vegas, by the way, this trade show was in Las Vegas, so you were out there for Comic-Con. That's the comic book trade show. There's also the big computer tech show that's out there, electric vehicle show that's out there. And in a testament to the rise of the drone industry, the acting head of the Federal Aviation Administration addressed the nation's largest robotics conference to discuss the integration of unmanned aircraft in U.S. skies. Oh, we've talked about it here on this program. 30,000 drones over American skies watching us. Michael Huerta addressed an audience of hundreds in the vast ballroom at the Mandalay Bay Hotel at the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International Trade Show. It marked the very first time an FAA administrator addressed the show in its 39-year history. In his speech, Huerta spoke about the evolution of aviation and the FAA's response to change. He told drone manufacturers and government officials that his agency was prepared for the thousands of drone aircraft that are expected to be flying in U.S. skies within the next 3 years. Oh, not 30. 3 years. Huerta talked about this year's creation of an FAA office to oversee unmanned systems integration and the process of picking 6 drone test sites across the country by the end of the year. The new office has a lot underway, he said. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to move drone integration forward, but I'm very, very optimistic we will get there. Currently, drones are not allowed to fly in the U.S. except with special permission from the FAA. But as technology becomes more advanced and demand increases, I'm sorry, who's demanding this? Are you? What? No, the consumer. Is the consumer demanding that drones fly in our airspace? 888-429-5471. I'm sorry, isn't drone technology, military technology used by warfighters in the battlefield? We are not the enemy. We are not the enemy. There are also privacy concerns about the drone's use of high-powered cameras, which will one day be able to fly above backyard pool parties and other private activities. Oh, I really don't think that's the worry. I don't think that's the purpose at all. Oh, hey, let's fly drones so we can find out what the Joneses are doing in their pool party behind their fence in the privacy of their own home. No, I don't think so. Those high-powered cameras, high-resolution cameras, are designed to do one thing, one primary thing. Can you guess what it is? Can you say license plates? Ah, very good, very good. We're talking about hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars in traffic citations handed out by drones by picking up license plate numbers of thousands and thousands of drivers an hour, sending that information to law enforcement officials. Troopers can go out there and pull cars over by the pack load and write citations. And it will not be long, no, it will not be long before the drones can take a photograph of your car, blow it up to your license plate number, run that on a database, get all your personal information, including where you live, send you the citation, and then you will have to pay it or not drive anymore. Not only that, it's going to know where you've driven your car, whether you stay in your own neighborhood or whether you travel interstate, whether your car is registered or not in the county where you live. Is it registered in one state and you're living in another state to get out of paying those taxes, to get out of paying that inspection? Oh, yes, all that information will be fed into the database. And that's just the starters. Huerta said the FAA has repeatedly reached out for public input to address worries about how drones will be used. Have you responded? Have you heard of one of these outreach efforts by the FAA? So, will fine-tuning the technology solve the problem, do you think? The Unmanned Vehicle Group's trade show has more than 500 exhibitors showing off robotic technology of all stripes, in the air, on land, in the sea. It began Tuesday and ends Thursday. Well, I'm trying to see if I have this article. Let me see my stack of stuff here. Okay, I'm gonna do it now. I'm gonna bring this in now because it's important before we get to the top of the hour. One of the reasons that this may be important, and I use may with a small m, not underlined, is that this week we discovered that a Russian Akula-class sub, that's a boomer. For those of you that don't know what a boomer is, a boomer carries water-to-air missiles, like intercontinental ballistic missiles, except they've already taken the intercontinental part out. And this boomer was cruising around the Gulf of Mexico. It could have been for up to a month. Now, here's the kicker. We didn't find out it was there until a week after it was gone. This is where drone technology could come in handy. There are 27,000 oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. 27,000 oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. If you wanted to take an oil rig tour, and you went to 5 oil rigs a day by boat, and I'm talking, you know, a regular 30-knot boat, not a high-speed cigarette boat. 5 oil rigs a day. It would take you almost 20 years to see them all. Now, how hard would it be to go out there and anchor drones at a strategic number of oil rigs? The drone could sit there 100 feet below the water and just wait and listen. And when traffic like that is sensed coming into the water, the drone would release. They're so small, they look smaller than a dolphin, some of them. Swim up to that submarine, take whatever photographs are necessary, or attach a tracking device like a small GPS chip or whatever. And every time that sub surfaced, we would know exactly where it was. GPS chips don't work underwater, by the way. That's one of the neat things about subs, is when they're underwater. You can't reach them by radio. The only way to reach them, they have to put a wire out on the water, and only at that time can you communicate with them. That's why they use the ELF frequencies to broadcast them a code. But once they're underwater again, they're out of communication. There's no way to communicate unless they send a buoy up with a radio message. So, in that case, maybe they're justified. Because that's really defense. That's common defense. That's offshore. That's to defend us against enemies. But flying drones over our airspace, if you think that has something to do with protecting us and that's part of the mission of the Department of Defense, I want you to give me a call and see if we can talk about it a little bit. 888-429-5471. Let's go ahead and I think it would be a good time to take a break. Let's just go ahead and take a quick break. Let's see if I can find where I'm at with my playlist here and see what we can do. We'll be back in about 6 minutes. Don't go away. Thank you.
And I hardly know your name. And if I say I love you in the candlelight, there's no one but myself to blame. But there's something inside that's turning my mind away. Oh, I could love you if I could let you stay.
Yeah.
All right, welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Just a couple of quick things. Audience is a little light today. We're competing against summertime. Labor Day weekend coming up next weekend. We're glad you're here with us tonight, those of you that are listening. Appreciate you hanging around. Without you, we wouldn't have a program. We're ultimately grateful to the folks down at BBS Radio who have such a great love and such a great passion for what we do. And that's why we can come to you each week. We're in our eighth year now here at BBS Radio. It's the number one network on the web, and X Squared Radio is often the number one program on that network. We wouldn't be there without you. We appreciate you. We appreciate your patronage. Please visit our affiliates, not the least of which is the Food Investor. Make sure to take care of yourself. Put together that 72-hour kit. If it takes you 2 or 3 weeks to save up to get that together, do that. Because we want you to take care of yourself. We want you to take care of your neighbors and your family. It's important. You're important to us. You matter to us. Spread the word. Tell a friend about X Squared Radio, because here is where the real free press occurs. We will keep you informed, which will keep you empowered. It'll give you control over your own life because you will know what's going on. Yes, you'll get my opinion too. But that's why you listen to X Squared Radio. I just want you to know I appreciate you every single day. And when I love the mail that you send me, I answer every single person that writes me. It might take me a couple of days, but I will write you back. bagnew@x2-radio.com. Share your thoughts with me. I'll share mine back. Thank you so much. Now, let's get started with hour two of X Squared Radio. You're here. I'm here. Let's talk about the news. Now, this hour is where we take the drone czar us story to the next level. Now, it's one thing to say that the military is all about, you know, grabbing up the next technology or funding it for that matter. Heck, they're creating jobs. All of these guys that have been playing video games since they were 8 years old now get to build the real stuff. Robotic exoskeletons for soldiers, or drones that fly in the air, can take off and land, or are thrown into the air by a soldier in the field to give you that critical eye in the sky to be able to look over the fence through the darkness or the fog to protect your own lives or to give you some kind of advantage. But we're not the only ones with drones. Now, there are lots and lots of countries. We went through a list. They're too long to recite here tonight, but everyone, from Argentina to Australia to Russia, Germany, Israel, the United States, Canada, Belgium, the list goes on and on and on, and we've been using drones for a long time, and they're getting more and more sophisticated. So of those 30,000 drones that will be flying overhead, watching your license plate, watching you, watching your neighbor, they might not all be ours. Despite concerns about U.S.-made drones ending up in enemy hands, American military contractors are lobbying the government to loosen export restrictions and open up foreign markets to the unmanned aircraft that have reshaped modern warfare. By the way, I heard tonight on the news that over 4,000 people have been killed in the last 41 months using drones. Companies such as Northrop Grumman and other arms makers. Oh, by the way, Pakistan is one of the world's largest drone makers, and Israel as well. Israel has a factory here in this country making drones. They're eager to tap a growing foreign appetite for high-tech and relatively cheap drones already being sold on the world market by countries such as Israel and China. And don't forget, almost all the chips for these are made in China. And they come with firmware and software and hardware, and China has all the back doors to all the chips. Export restrictions are hurting this industry in America without making us any safer, Wesley G. Bush, Northrop's chief executive, said at a defense conference this year. The U.S. is struggling to sell unmanned aircraft to our allies while other nations prepare to jump into this marketplace with both feet. The defense industry may want to sell more drones overseas, but arms control advocates are alarmed. The potential for these weapons to fall into enemy hands is great, they say, the RQ-170 notwithstanding. That's the drone that Iran took over as we were flying it over their sovereign airspace, and they flew it to the ground. Now, they might have damaged the landing gear, but by and large, the thing was retrieved intact. Had advanced stealth technology, had a classified propulsion technology on it, and, of course, all the high-tech surveillance gear on it. How did they do it? Well, there's a variety of ways. Some people say that they gave it a stronger GPS signal, which threw it off, but all that really does is confuse the drone. Now, this one was grabbed with a flight command and flown to the ground with a joystick. May have a little hard landing, but by no means did it cartwheel across the desert. It landed on some airport somewhere. Why? Well, because the firmware backdoor was given to them by the people that make the chips. So they just sent it the right signal, took over the flight controls, and a little rocky at first, but flying the things is a piece of cake. Landing them while looking out of a camera the size of a drinking straw, that's a little trickier. Daryl Kimball, executive director of Arms Control Association, said that drone sales are problematic because the unmanned vehicles are more affordable than any other military aircraft, and with no human pilot to risk, drones could make it easier to decide to go to war. You can arm a drone. We had a story on this program 4 weeks ago where Raytheon has now developed a 2-foot-long missile. It's not the big, heavy Hellfire missile. These are a smaller, lighter version designed to only take out maybe a 100-foot radius. Extremely targeted weaponry. As the U.S. war effort draws down and the Pentagon budget shrinks, and oh, it will shrink, defense companies say they need Congress to ease restrictions so they can tap lucrative foreign markets for their wares. Otherwise, they face going out of business, or even worse, being bought out by one company with the most money. Once all the drone technology ends up under one roof, you have the makings of a Cyberdyne Systems. More important, they say, the current export restrictions may cause the U.S. to lose potential customers to nations eager to elbow their way into the market, like Argentina or Pakistan. Israel is making drones and selling them to several countries, including Azerbaijan, India, and Ecuador. Oh, India is making their own drones as well, and so is Ecuador. The world appetite for drones will be vividly on display next week at the Farnborough International Air Show in England, one of the largest aerospace showcases. While American aerospace firms are expected to brag about their unusual big sales of commercial jets, attack helicopters, and fighter planes, they will have to sit idly by and watch as foreign countries work to land lucrative deals for fresh batches of drones. Why? Because, according to our laws, we cannot export anything that could be used in a military fashion by a country that is not one of our allies. It's a complex set of laws, and believe me, everything from fan belts to special computers to all kinds of lamination technologies, you're not allowed to ship those, not allowed to export them. Much new business is likely to be generated in the market, and if U.S. companies fail to capture this market share, European, Russian, Israeli, Chinese, or South African companies will. Well, interesting. Now, we have talked about drones, and we have talked about drone killing drones. And next week we have Noel Sharkey, who is a professor of artificial intelligence and robotics at Sheffield University, is going to be on this program. Yes, we're going to talk about drones and robots and anti-drones and drone-killing drones and drone-killing, drone-killing, drone-killing drones. But we're also going to talk about the slippery slope of the sanitization of killing. Once, as I said in the first hour, we charged across the frozen tundra at one another. Now we digitize one another, and it's simply a score in a giant video game. Well, the drone-killing drones are making that a little harder to do. And now we have swarming technology where half a dozen drones can go up and attack one drone or a ground target like a tank or a machine gun nest or something like that. Several drones attacking from several different angles, communicating with one another autonomously. You get the picture. Warfare is going to get very complicated very fast. And if we ever turn out to be the enemy, things could go bad. How bad? Well, I'm not the only one that thinks this way. Am I sitting on the sidelines? Am I one man out here with my own thoughts? I think not. I have some evidence to prove it. You know, I like watching the Weather Channel every now and then. Sometimes just turn the sound down and turn the stereo up and just watch the weather service. Interesting stuff, the Weather Channel, showing all kinds of cool stuff. And I got to tell you, hands down, Fox News has the most incredibly beautiful weather girls. That's just the way of the world, folks. Tornadoes are just sexy. What can I say? But it's not all fun and games with the NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Aeronautical Association. Yes, they give great weather reports. Oh, they got the best satellites. They look at the Earth from space. Everything is peaceful and blue and quiet and predictable. And it's a wonderful advanced science. So what does hollow point bullets have to do with the weather? Why would the National Weather Service need to purchase large quantities of hollow point 40 caliber ammunition? That's the question many are asking after the federal agency followed in the footsteps of the Department of Homeland Security in putting out a solicitation. A solicitation is a request for quotation by private contractors or providers that are on the GSA, that is the General Services Administration list. Okay? They followed in the footsteps of the Department of Homeland Security in putting out its own solicitation for 46,000 rounds of hollow point bullets. A solicitation which appears on the FedBizOps website. You can check it out yourself. FedBizOps.gov. Okay? It's out there. Now, they ask for 16,000 rounds of 40 caliber Smith & Wesson jacketed hollow point bullets, noted for their strength and also for their ability to, if you're hit anywhere except, I believe it is the little finger, it's pretty much fatal. If you are hit with one of these bullets, you're going to go down and you're going to require major surgery, and that's only if you're within eyesight of the hospital. If you're not, you're going to die. Now, I will say that it's a great round and it's fun to shoot. But these are to be delivered to locations in Ellsworth, Maine and New Bedford, Massachusetts. I'm sorry, folks. I'm just not getting it. When did weather become so darn dangerous? Is it they have to protect those great-looking weather girls? I don't know. Further, 6,000 rounds of Smith & Wesson jacketed hollow points will be sent to Wall, New Jersey, with another 24,000 rounds of the same bullets heading to the weather station in St. Petersburg, Florida. The solicitation also asks for 500 paper targets. Let me do the math here. 46,000 rounds, 500 paper targets. I'm sure it's just for target practice, don't you think? The National Weather Service is one of six scientific agencies that make up the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The solicitation requires a response by August 21st. Well, that's the day after tomorrow. That's pretty quick. I guess they're in a big hurry. The NWS, National Weather Service, is following its federal counterpart in the DHS in securing large quantities of ammo back in March, by the way, just a few months ago. Homeland Security purchased, they already got them, 450 million rounds of 40 caliber hollow point bullets that are designed to expand upon entry and cause maximum organ damage, prompting questions as to why the DHS needed such a large amount of powerful bullets merely for training purposes. Well, wait a minute. Who asked the questions? Was it Congress? No. Was it the news services? No. Was it the public? No, we didn't know. So who got prompted to ask these questions? And was it before the purchase order was approved for 450 million rounds? Folks, there's only 300 million people in the United States, and half of them are kids. Okay? A little over 150 million adults in the U.S. What does DHS need 450 rounds of a pistol round for? These are not rifle bullets. A Glock 40 shoots this weapon, shoots this ammo. It doesn't fit in a 40 caliber, 45 caliber ACP in 1911 A1, of which there are millions of them in the United States. It doesn't fit in a 38 caliber police weapon. It doesn't fit in a 357 Magnum. It fits in a 40 caliber Glock, which is a government round and a government weapon. And there are a lot of people that own them, but not nearly as many as own the smaller calibers. As the Bureau Insider notes, hollow points have been illegal in international warfare since 1899. That's right. In warfare, we use a full metal jacket bullet. There is no hollow point. The bullet is designed to go clean through and disable a troop, unless, of course, it hits a bone. Then you have another problem. But this is considered a Geneva Convention that you do not use hollow point bullets. Why are hollow point bullets being ordered and received using taxpayer dollars inside the United States? These are domestic organizations. The DHS is also planning to purchase a further 750 million rounds of different types of ammo in a separate solicitation that also expires tomorrow, including 357 Magnum rounds that are able to penetrate walls. The DHS recently put out an order for riot gear in preparation for the upcoming DNC, RNC, and presidential inauguration. Really? Are you expecting more protests than normal at a presidential election? Well, they're not the only ones. This one actually makes sense. The U.S. Army is also busy buying similar equipment. Now, wait a minute. Isn't the U.S. Army designed for foreign wars? We don't use the U.S. Army inside the United States. That's against the Constitution. You can't use federal troops against U.S. citizens. We haven't done that since 1863. That's right. 1863. The Gettysburg. That's the last time federal troops were ordered out. Of course, it was a two-year campaign, but when it was finished, Reconstruction began and hasn't been allowed since. It's against the Constitution. You have to use the National Guard, but the National Guard is busy overseas. So now it's the U.S. Army that's buying riot gear. I don't think they're going to quell riots in Baghdad. I think they're going to quell riots here. Are you planning to riot anytime soon? Really? The DHS also recently purchased a number of bulletproof checkpoint booths that include stop-and-go lights. You've seen them before, right? They look like a giant half of a barbecue cooker turned on its side. Bulletproof glass, red light, green light. Three or four guys can kind of hide behind it. It's got a loudspeaker on it, and they can say, you know, go, stop. Why would you need something like that? We have a wonderful traffic control system in just about every city in our country. Could it be because they're not planning on using the traffic system? Or maybe they're planning on trafficking something else besides cars? The federal government is clearly gearing up for the likelihood of civil unrest on a scale that could outstrip what we've already seen in countries across Europe, Greece, Spain, Italy, Egypt. While the establishment demonizes the Second Amendment in light of recent mass shootings, and legislation is preparing to ban the sale of large quantities of ammunition online, the federal government is acquiring ammunition at levels necessary to fight a full-scale domestic war. The Washington Post now reports via a statement from NOAA spokesman Scott Smullen that the original solicitation contained a clerical error, and that the solicitation for ammunition and targets for the NOAA Fisheries Office of Law Enforcement mistakenly identified NOAA's National Weather Service as the requesting office. Really? Four offices worth around the country? This still doesn't explain why hollow point bullets. Well, those fish, you know, they can be really violent. I don't know. It's entirely possible, given the sordid history of Fast and Furious, a federal government program under which guns were directly sent to Mexican drug cartels, doesn't look like things are going to turn out well. As I have often said, folks down at Wars R Us don't need a reason to have a war. They only need a weapon. Well, you know, the National Weather Service, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Clerical error, hollow point bullets, 500 paper targets. Maybe, you know, poaching has become a really violent business and maybe they need it. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. But what about the peaceful people down at the Social Security Administration? Oh, yeah, they're in on it too. 174,000 rounds of hollow point bullets. First it was the Department of Homeland Security, then it was the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and now the Social Security Administration is set to purchase 174,000 rounds of hollow point bullets that will be delivered to 41 locations across the country. A clerical error? Again? A solicitation posted by the SSA on, again, the Fed BizOps website asks for contractors to supply 174,000 rounds of 357 125 grain bonded jacketed hollow point pistol ammunition. That's a police round. An online ammunition retailer describes the bullets as suitable for peak performance, rivaling and sometimes surpassing hand loads in many guns, noting that the ammo is a great personal defense bullet. The synopsis to the solicitation adds, the synopsis is kind of the front paragraph that describes what the solicitation is all about so the contractor can accurately respond to it, adds that the ammunition is to be shipped to 41 locations within 60 days of purchase. A separate spreadsheet lists those locations, which I'm not going to read tonight because we're going to run out of time if I do, which includes the Social Security headquarters in Baltimore, Maryland, as well as major cities across the country, including Los Angeles, Detroit, Oklahoma City, Dallas, Houston, Atlanta, Denver, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Seattle. Wow, that sounds like a national invasion of a global scale. Hollow point bullets are designed to expand as they enter the body, causing maximum damage by tearing apart internal organs. As I said, you better be within eyesight of a hospital when you're shot by one of these. It's not outlandish to suggest that the Social Security Administration is purchasing the bullets as part of its preparation for civil unrest. Social Security welfare is estimated to keep around 40% of senior citizens out of poverty. Should the tap run dry in the aftermath of an economic collapse, which the Federal Reserve has already told top bankers to prepare for, domestic disorder could ensue if people are refused their benefits. You remember seeing the pictures in Greece? Well, I'm sorry, but the ones I saw families, ordinary people out there on the streets throwing Molotov cocktails, rocks, throwing batons, fences, things like that at the police. And I remember the police having shields and helmets and riot gear on, and they're whacking a few heads and pushing people back, but I don't remember seeing a single 357 Magnum anywhere. Looks like we have a little different plan in store. You know, there are two types of weapons. We've talked about it on this program. I talk about it in the book Alienated Nation. There are lethal weapons, which are, of course, designed to kill. Bullets, bombs, missiles, all kinds of stuff like that. Gas, poisons, different weapons like that. And then there are shock weapons. Lethal weapons are designed to kill. Shock weapons are designed to make men obey. Shock weapons are rarely lethal unless you're a particularly weak person. Pepper spray, batons, rubber bullets, bean bags, sonic weapons, all kinds of weapons that are designed to break you down but not kill you. The art of good governing is knowing which weapon to use when. And it's rare that governments make a complete blunder of the fact. Yes, no, it doesn't work. When you have a border patrol guard shooting beanbags while the drug cartel personnel are shooting automatic weapons back at you, you end up dead. That doesn't work. But if you're going at protesting seniors who are saying, hey, I didn't get my Social Security check the first of this month, what's going on? You return fire, not with gas or a hose or a dog or a sonic weapon, but a 40 caliber hollow point bullet. I think you have a different situation on your hands. Indeed, earlier this year, the Department of Homeland Security ran a drill called Operation Shield, which included turning the entrance of a Florida Social Security office into a checkpoint manned by Federal Protective Service officers armed with semi-automatic rifles. With their blue and white SUVs circled around the main street office, at least one official was posted on the door with a semi-automatic rifle, randomly checking identifications, and other officers, some with K-9s, those are big German Shepherd dogs, sifted through the building. A rash of solicitations by federal agencies for hollow point bullets in recent months has stoked fears that the government is preparing for civil unrest caused by a financial collapse on a scale similar to, or even larger to, scenes already witnessed in Europe over the last 2 years. As we reported yesterday, I already told you about the 46,000 rounds and 500 paper targets. This does not bode well. It gets worse, and I'm going to cover it. You know I will. The Department of Homeland Security also purchased massive amounts of explosives. That's right. Can anyone explain out there why this is happening? 888-429-5471. The Department of Homeland Security needs 700 pounds of high-density ammonium nitrate, You remember that, don't you? Terry Nichols, Oklahoma City. And 700 pounds of A5 Flake RDX. Now, those of you that are not organic chemists, I don't expect you to understand what that is, but I will tell you. Flake RDX is the raw material for C4. All you need is the plasticizer. And by the way, straight RDX can be stabilized with a small amount of plasticizer and made into any shape. A brick, a Coke bottle, a soccer ball, anything that you want to make out of it. It's completely stable against shock, against fire. It needs a blasting cap to go off. When it does, it exceeds 5,500 meters per second when it explodes. That's about 2.5 times the explosive power of TNT. Well, the DHS placed a solicitation by way of the Transportation Safety Administration. You know, the good folks down at the TSA that greet you at the airport with a smile on their face and rubber gloves. For these products, with a delivery date of, you guessed it, August 31st, 12 days from now. For those of you in the know, these are the ingredients to build a makeshift bomb. However, the project claims it is for canine explosive training aids. Really? 700 pounds of it? How many dogs do you have? Because it only takes about a teaspoon to train a dog. And you can spread a teaspoon over a building, small little pinch here and a pinch there. 700 pounds to train dogs? How did you get that past the purchasing agent? Didn't you think we would see it at fedbizops.gov? One wonders what they need with over a half a ton of explosive nitrates. Congress gave oversight to the DHS of procurement of ammonium nitrate after requesting they, quote, regulate the sale and transfer of ammonium nitrate by an ammonium nitrate facility to prevent the misappropriation or use of ammonium nitrate in an act of terrorism. It has been done in this country, or so they say. If you really believe that ammonium nitrate in 55-gallon drums is what took the front off of the federal building in Oklahoma City, I've got some beachfront property in Arkansas I'd love to sell you. The Ammonium Nitrate Security Program focuses on preventing a terrorist attack by the use of ammonium nitrate in a homemade bomb by requiring that its sale and those that purchase it be registered with the DHS. Purchasers are screened against the terrorist screening database. In the solicitation, the DHS, by the way, that's fertilizer. Yeah, that's ordinary fertilizer, not the 1010 like you put on your grass. But the 46-2020, that's the stuff. In the solicitation, the DHS did not specify information that a corporation seeking to reply with a bid would need. You understand what that means? In the solicitation, that's the thing that they post on FedBizOps, you know, the description of how the contractor is supposed to comply. The DHS did not specify information that a corporation seeking to reply with a bid would need. In other words, a fertilizer company, a hardware store, they need certain information about it. The DHS is requesting that high-density ammonium nitrate and RDX, that's the booster, be delivered to an undisclosed government facility in downtown Atlantic City, New Jersey. I'm shaking my head here, folks. The Pentagon has come before Congress decrying that domestic terrorist acts may increase with the use of improvised explosive devices. Those are IEDs. You've heard about them in the news. In the U.S., they are asking Congress to lay aside posse comitatus, that's the PCA, in an effort to increase their use of military on the streets of America. Posse comitatus is what makes it illegal to use federal troops inside the United States. You have to use National Guard, but National Guard can't be trusted to do what they need to do because you can't pick up National Guard in Cincinnati and send them to Fort Worth, Texas, and tell them to arrest Americans. It doesn't work. DHS has already put in massive orders, as I've already explained to you, for hollow point bullets. So what does the evidence mean to you? Well, now there's martial law training in St. Louis as military police train to drive tanks through the streets of America. You never thought it would come. How many of you have sat in your front porch, on your front porch, in your swing with your wife or with your two daughters and some ice cold lemonade on a summer afternoon and seen federal tanks rolling down your street? I haven't. I mean, I've seen them on the freeway on a convoy going here or there with, you know, brand new ones maybe, but I've never seen them actually with helmeted, sunglassed, radioed operators driving up and down the street. Well, according to KSDK reporter Casey Nolan, a one-week training exercise is being conducted from June 22nd to the 29th in St. Charles County, St. Louis, Missouri. Training exercises such as this have been occurring more frequently, and a very credible link can be drawn between this exercise and recent DHS informant who indicated that plans are being made for martial law due to civil unrest or war. Do you really expect war to come to this country? St. Louis City residents should not be alarmed if they see military vehicles in the neighborhood. Don't worry. Everything is okay. Go back to the mall. Heavily armed vehicles are rolling into town, and while they come in peace, there are all kinds of rumors about why they are here. Alex Thomas says, this is the corporate media telling you, do not be alarmed. The military is just in your city training to take on the American people. No big deal here. This event was not very prominent on the KSDKcom news site. No additional information seems to be available. Nothing reportable here. Nothing's happening here. These are not the droids you're looking for. Gannett Companies owns Army Times Publishing Company. Publications including Army Times, Navy Times, Air Force Times, Marine Corps Times, and Defense News and Federal Times. It's important to note that there is no mention of this week-long military exercise on the Army Times site. That would indicate that the exercise is either classified or the public awareness was to be kept to a minimum. Why? Another note from Alex Thomas. The news report by the Gannett-owned corporate media propaganda station was thoroughly disgusting. There was once a time in America where the military would never consider openly training on the streets of America. Well, Mr. Thomas, you don't remember back to World War II when young boys used to walk the streets of Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Why? Well, because that's Hub City. That's where the trains come in. That's where the trains depart for the coast, where the boats are. Where the boys would practice in the woods around Hattiesburg, Mississippi, practicing to kill people. They would come to town and have a few beers or an ice cream or take in a movie. And they would get on the train and they would disappear and they would never come home. Now let's cover the recent release of information from a DHS informant that was broadcast in an interview with private investigator Doug Hagman. In the May 2nd interview, Doug reveals some disturbing inside information and recent moves that indicate martial law may possibly be implemented before the end of the year. One can download the interview. All you got to do is go to truenews.com. and look it up for yourself. I'm not going to play it on this program. I'm just letting you know that's where you can find it. In an article by Paul Joseph Watson entitled, Don't Be Alarmed, Army Trains MPs to Drive Tanks on U.S. Streets, Paul highlights some important background information on this, quote, Army training, which the average person is unaware of, namely, that National Guard and U.S. Army troops are routinely involved in urban warfare training drills. Usually, such drills take place within the confines of military bases. You know, they drive around base housing. However, more recently, heavily armed troops are increasingly seen patrolling residential neighborhoods and even the downtown areas of major U.S. cities. Such, quote, invasions are often reported on as nothing to worry about and even as cool by the name mainstream media. Back in 2008, the Washington Post reported how 20,000 U.S. troops returning from Iraq would be stationed inside America under NORTHCOM for purposes of domestic security from September 2011 onwards. That's less than a year ago. NORTHCOM officials were forced to subsequently issue a denial after the Army Times initially reported that the troops would be used to deal with civil unrest and crowd control. Yeah, that's right. The Army Times actually reported that. It is reasonable to be concerned about a military exercise such as this, regardless of what the official explanation is. My question to you is, do you believe them or do you not? 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Are they really practicing for martial law and civil unrest? Have we ever had martial law in this country before? Do you remember when? Well, not unless you're very old. We had an internment program going on in this country during World War II. Was it legal? Yes, it was. Was it constitutional? Yes, it was. Was it inhumane? Yes, it was. As world leaders prepare to meet in the Windy City for their annual NATO summit, U.S. federal officials are working feverishly to implement a security net so broad that it encompasses the entirety of Cook County, Illinois. I don't know if you know where that is, but I'm going to explain that in just a second. While international summits are traditionally met with a larger police presence and preparations for the possibility of protests or rioting, what's taking place on American soil outside of Chicago in anticipation of the May 20th meeting in downtown can be interpreted in only one way, the implementation of regionalized martial law. It's a little bit old article, but it says, last week, Red Cross officials reported that the City of Chicago, Department of Homeland Security, and the Secret Service had instructed them to prepare for a mass evacuation of the city in the event of an emergency during the NATO summit. The Red Cross was to prepare to shelter and feed residents in the event of such an evacuation. Feds are really exercising in a lot of different ways that are alarming. The Illinois Department of Transportation is testing an emergency plan to shut off access into and out of downtown Chicago. The plan uses a network of highway security gates that are designed to shut down all traffic coming in and out of Chicago in the event of a terrorist attack. What's a terrorist attack? I mean, is it the advent of a terrorist attack, the thought of a terrorist attack? Is it an angry person? Is it somebody shooting up a Chick-fil-A? What are we talking about here? Anyway, let's talk to John from Vancouver, line two. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Dr. Agnew.
How are you, sir? How are things out in the very far west in the peaceful next to the Pacific Ocean?
Well, they're pretty peaceful, and the weather's good and enjoying life.
Well, that's good. Pardon me.
Okay. The only reason I called in is because no one else called in, because I don't really have a lot to say. What I'm observing is, you're painting a certain kind of picture, which... What you're saying is compelling. What you're saying is the evidence is piling up, so on and so forth. I'm trying, like for an average person, is an average person gonna collect together with other average people that have some guns and take on what might be the military coming down on citizenship? Is that what's going on?
Well, I think that's what they believe is going on. I think there are more guns in this country than there are people. But that doesn't mean that we would do anything more than go hunt Bambi in the woods with it. You know, we're here basically armed with the Second Amendment as an idea, as a function of dichotomy between what government is supposed to do and what it is doing. And as long as the government knows that it's going to have a fight on its hands if it goes marching down the street and tries to take weapons on a wholesale basis from Americans, it keeps them at bay. But now it seems as though the ante has been raised, doesn't it to you?
The only thing that I can say is there's something coming down the pike, and it's something really big, and it's going to divide. That's what I would say to it. Pretty general, but I don't have any more specific things than that. I don't own a gun. I don't plan to buy one. I might plan to buy a bow. Excuse me. But I'm, you know, whatever might be coming down the pike, I'd be willing to shoot firearms. I shot plenty in my youth and that kind of thing. I can see what you're describing, and that the noose is tightening. That's what you're describing, and that's what seems to be going on. I'm just not willing to respond on that level. I'm not sure what to do, but
I'm actually
shooting
glad.
Off.
I'm glad about that you would not respond. And what I'm hoping for, what I'm really trying to get out there tonight, is that perhaps the humans that are behind the sunglasses and behind the camo uniforms and bulletproof vests will feel exactly the same way you do. They're not willing to march down the asphalt streets of America and follow those kinds of orders.
You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, it does make sense if you think about the very small number of people that are in power. Their jig is up. We already know what they're up to. We already know that the dollar is going to collapse. We know that the big banks are running hedge funds, which are betting against business doing well. We already know they're printing money and devaluing it at a record pace. And they do too. But that doesn't mean they want to give up their place of power.
You know, I am so glad that you said that. Because they are losing their power, and it's a desperate attempt. And I think if you don't respond, especially if you don't respond violently, and you stand your ground, I think this thing can be overcome and. Normalcy will return, and we can actually, at that point, define what normalcy is.
Well, my prayer is that you're exactly right. If we let me just put it to you this way: if 150 million Fred Sanfords go out there unarmed and stand in the streets and say, "You will not march here," maybe the army will lay its weapons down or turn around and say, "No, sir. No, sir."
Well, I would say, you know, the Defense Department is, they already know they're not defending the country. They're defending high-level, high-power interests. Oil would have a lot to do with it. There might be other interests. They already know they're not defending the country. And so what you described, standing up very peacefully to convince the army that, hey, you know, you're supposed to be working for us, and who are you working for now? You already know who you're working for now. Like, give it up. Give it up. And if you do it peacefully, I would say, yes, it can be done.
Well, you know what keeps a nation free, Thomas Jefferson said, are two things. The first is a decentralized, locally controlled education system. Local school boards, local parents running those school boards, and they handle the curricula that's taught to their students. And, you know, as long as their students can learn how to learn and learn how to think and get a decent job, then it's doing its job. That's the first thing. The second is that you have a free press. That is to say, you have a press that looks at and notices when government does things wrong and reports it to the people. Because an informed electorate can make decisions to keep the country on an even keel. It's when things happen behind closed doors or when the reporters themselves are either killed or threatened to be killed that freedom disappears. That's why I'm sorry to put this in here parenthetically, John, but today Julian Assange went out on a balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy in London and made a public statement. You probably didn't hear it because there was a complete media blackout inside the United States. I heard it about it on Drudge Report and looked up the speech myself and heard it on the BBC. But Julian Assange...
That's where I heard it.
Yeah, Julian Assange has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Why? Because he's a reporter. And what he did is he revealed the murder of 89,000 people by interests that were friendly to the United States. That's embarrassing. And for that, he faces the death penalty in our country if they can ever get him out of that embassy. If you do that to your reporters, then you have lost your free press and you have lost your freedom.
You know, as far as free education goes and actually free reporting goes, I would say the web provides that. You know, I wouldn't look to the networks or anything like that, but you can certainly find it if you take the time to search. You know, you being an example of that, you know, I had to search you out. I've searched other people out, and so I do get accurate information. In response to Assange, like I heard the BBC report, what he said was, you know, the U.S. should renounce and renounce and renounce. What I think he should have said was, look, I provided a space or a place for people to provide information. I didn't make this up. I didn't, force people to download the information onto my site. So if you really want to go after people, you go after the people that deposited the information on my site. I didn't force them. And I didn't hear him say that. I think that to me is the issue. He just provided the platform. People who chose to download, that's who the U.S. should be after, because, you know, if Assange is put away, another platform is going to appear, and that's another thing he should have said was, you prosecute me, the next one's going to come up, and you're going to have people downloading anyway.
Well, he's already said that if anything happens to him, there's enough information cocked and ready to go at servers all over the country that they will be very sorry that they took him out.
Well, that's even further evidence that, you know, those who are trying to control are losing it. So even though, you know, the bullets bought, you know, all that kind of thing, the training within cities, to me, those are intimidating tactics when, and as you suggested, it just takes people in every community to just peacefully stand up and say, look, we are the people. Well, did you forget? Did you forget who you're defending? And that should not be that difficult.
Yeah, I agree. One of my closest friends said yesterday, wait a minute, we are not the enemy. We're not the enemy,
right,
John.
Exactly. Yeah. So I just think it's intimidating tactics to try and scare people out of their minds, to try and provoke them to do silly things. But a calm standing up is going to work.
I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more.
Okay, Dr. Agnew, I have to do some dinner, so I'm going to sign off, and it was such a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the call. It gave me a wonderful cross thought, so I appreciate you very much. Thanks for listening.
I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, let's do this. By the way, Ted wrote in an interesting thing. He says, common sense tells me there may be a couple of possibilities. A, the government wants people to know about this firepower stockpiling so they can continue their Fear Factor Obey Us or Else campaign. B, they're hedging their own protection in case of a U.S. currency collapse. And or C, they will buy up all the ammo in the marketplace and then ban the sale of ammo in the case that you know what hits the fan. That's kind of my vote. Either way, whatever they are doing it for is to protect their own power base. It is not for our security, that's for sure. And as I've said, I think what they're doing is they're calling our Second Amendment bluff. Let's go ahead and listen to some Civil Twilight, Letters from the Sky. Be right back.
Hold you like the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. So glad that you're here with us. We would not be here without you. That's for sure. We appreciate you being here. You never, ever are taken for granted here. We appreciate you being here with us more than you know. And thanks for the call. Thanks for John in Vancouver and his words last hour. This is the third hour of X Squared Radio tonight. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Just want to open this hour saying don't forget about the Maya 2012 conference beginning December 13th. You need to go to Maya 2012 by clicking on the orange banner at X Squared Radio and get signed up. Several hundred of you have already done that, but you have not started your obligation to go. I realize this is a big deal, but this might be the only conference you need to go to in the next 2 or 3 years. It's one that one for a lifetime, let me tell you. Also, don't forget about the Pythagoras conference coming up in October. It's in the Midwest. Great place to meet me and others. Be happy to sign your books, take a workshop from me. We're going to cover a lot of neat stuff. Also, don't forget to visit our affiliate, The Food Investor. They have a new 72-hour pack with all kinds of goodies. Believe me, it's everything you need to keep you and yours out of the hands of FEMA for 72 hours. They say that's about all you need in order to get to either more permanent supplies, like a neighbor or a family member in a distant city, or to be allowed to go back to your home and resume after something like a tornado, a flood, a fire, an earthquake, or, God forbid, some kind of insurrection. Just remember that we're thinking about you, and we're always looking for the best to bring you, and certainly the Food Investor is one of those. All right, let's get with the third hour here at X Squared Radio. Most of you are going to listen to this as an archive. We are competing against the absolutely awesome weather that we've had the last couple of days across the country, and we're happy that that those of you that are listening live are here. Now, we have some people that are listening, and they're in foreign countries, and they have chosen to write us instead of call in, and that's fine. Our good friend Ted has mentioned that what may be going on here is Rome 2.0. I think in my book, Alienated Nation, I'm talking about a constitutional convention, which is not driven by Congress. Congress has been emasculated, if you know what that means. Those of you that have a farm, you know what that means when you take the stud out and castrate him. That's emasculation. That's what's happened to Congress, top to bottom. They're completely powerless in Washington. What is running Washington now is the agency government, and everyone knows it, especially Congress and the Senate. They know that the agency government is running the country. That can be fixed because we have 40 states that have passed sovereignty acts, and all it takes is for those 40 governors to get together and sign a resolution that they are calling a constitutional convention. If they follow the outline that we have in the book, I have put into the book an outline similar to what Madison put together when the first constitutional convention took place. It's a little more aggressive because bold steps are needed. There are some things that we need to do that they could not do then. For instance, it doesn't take 2 to 6 weeks to get Congress to Washington to meet. They're there all the time. We can travel across the country in a matter of hours, not weeks. We don't take horses. We don't walk. We don't take a train. We can fly. We can get there in a matter of hours. There's absolutely no sense in Congress serving for 2 years. 2 years is too short of a time. We need to lengthen that term to 4 years. Then we need to take both houses, the Senate and Congress. The Senate is the analog of the House of Lords in England. The Congress is the analog of the House of Commons. Once we change those terms, then we need to put term limits in place. We have already seen what happens when we have career politicians, senators with 18, 24 years in office. They build dynasties, powerful dynasties. with political assassins that work for them. In Congress, we have the same thing. Individuals that have been reelected 16, 17, 18 times, they run the committees. They decide what laws come to the floor. They decide what representation we're going to have. And right now, we have none. The party that's in power and the party that's out of power, there's so little difference between them, it doesn't matter anymore. That can be fixed with the Constitutional Convention. We have agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus that are running our country. They are ruling our country. They're ruling you. They're assigning taxes to you. They're assigning fees to you. They're conducting enforcement actions on you. They are seizing your property and seizing your rights, and you have no representation in that government. That can be fixed with a constitutional amendment. I found it very interesting this week as I was watching the campaigns. I find it very entertaining, by the way. And just for the heck of it, I decided to go ahead and pick Romney's cabinet. Yeah, I just thought it would be fun, so I sat down and I tweeted. By the way, if you're not following me on Twitter, you can easily do that. I'm at Brooks Agnew. It's the easiest one in the world to get to. And I love to put this stuff out there. I tweeted Romney's cabinet, one line at a time. For Fed chairman, I picked Ron Paul. For head of Department of Homeland Security, I picked Sarah Palin. For attorney general, I picked Rudy Giuliani. I would dissolve the Department of Education altogether. I would take the Department of Education and reduce it down to only handling the nuclear regulatory things, only the nuclear power plants. The rest of the Department of Energy would be completely dissolved and then reformed under a 50-state coalition with representatives from every Department of Environmental Quality for all 50 states and Puerto Rico. They would make up a council which would review and pass all regulations which would be subject to ratification by Congress. The next thing that I did is I picked the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and last but not least, the Secretary of Commerce. I actually picked Donald Trump as the Secretary of Commerce. 30 minutes later, Donald Trump was on Greta Van Susteren being interviewed, and Greta asked him the question. So let me ask you, Mr. Trump, if you were to serve a cabinet position, which one would you serve? And Donald said, well, I'm not interested in being part of the cabinet. Well, I know you're not, but in the case that you were called to be a member of the cabinet, which department would you like to be over? And he said, well, I always thought that I would make a really good commerce secretary. I'm just telling you that because I nailed it. I nailed it. And you can go back and check the Twitter tweet is about 30 minutes before the announcement on Greta Van Susteren that that's the position he would accept. That's right. And by the way, I would pick Bolton as Secretary of State. And I think during these times, it would be a toss-up between General Petraeus as Secretary of Defense or Condoleezza Rice. I just think that those two would be eminently qualified to handle the tenuous times that we're in right now. Some people with reason. By the way, the DHS would be almost completely dismantled under Sarah Palin. She would return many of the rights that we have as Americans because it's all about liberty with the Tea Party. And I know that Ron Paul would do a heck of a job taking the Fed apart, opening up the vault and showing us the gold, spearheading the audit, and once and for all, taking back the ability to print money from the Fed and return it to Congress where it belongs. Those are just my ideas. If you feel that way as well, you can pick up a copy of Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. You can buy it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or everywhere fine books are sold, or you can buy it at the website, alienatednation.com. And if you do that, you will get the copy autographed by me, and you will get the entire book in audio for free as a download. The instant you buy it, it comes to you as the link in the PayPal receipt. So John says, I've painted a picture of something that could happen, that maybe would happen, and that's what we're trying to avoid. I have pages and pages and pages of evidence, and I would prefer not to go any further with it because we've already taken one full hour and we've talked about the possibility. If you would like to have my full 45-page report on this, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I'll be happy to send it to you, and you can read it for yourself. All of the links, all of the references, all of the article writers are there, and you can follow the information for yourself. Everything is there except for my commentary. But there's more going on in the world. You remember Fukushima. It hasn't been that long. Yes, the camera lights have died down on it, but there are still some studies going on, and we found out that Fukushima has caused mutant butterflies. And, insects are one of the first forms of life to respond to a change in environment. Genetic mutations have been found in three generations of butterflies from near Japan's crippled Fukushima nuclear plant. Scientists said Tuesday of this week, around 12% of pale grass blue butterflies that were exposed to nuclear fallout as larvae immediately after the tsunami-sparked disaster had abnormalities, including smaller wings and damaged eyes. The insects were mated in a laboratory well outside the fallout zone, and 18% of their offspring displayed similar problems. That figure rose to 34% in the third generation of butterflies, even though one parent from each coupling was from an unaffected population. The researchers also collected another 240 butterflies in Fukushima in September last year, 6 months after the disaster. Abnormalities were recorded in 52% of their offspring, which was a dominantly high ratio. Joji Otaki, who is the researcher that did this, said the high ratio could result from both external and internal exposure to radiation from the atmosphere and in contaminated foodstuffs like the flowers that they sample. The results of the study were published in Scientific Reports, an online research journal from the publishers of Nature magazine. Otaki later carried out a comparison test in Okinawa, exposing unaffected butterflies to low levels of radiation, with the results showing similar rates of abnormality. We have reached the firm conclusion that radiation released from the Fukushima Daiichi plant damaged the genes of the butterflies. The quake-sparked tsunami of March 2011 knocked out cooling systems at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, causing three reactors to go into meltdown in the world's worst atomic disaster for 25 years. That's the official statement. Those of you that listen to this program or have talked to or listened to Jim Stone know that's not exactly what happened. First of all, there weren't three reactors that went into meltdown. One of the reactors didn't have any fuel in it at all, and didn't even have a containment around it, and yet it still exploded. The findings will raise fears over the long-term effects of the leaks on people who were exposed in the days and weeks after the incident as radiation spread over a large area and forced thousands to evacuate. There are photographs of the town today, and the streets are absolutely abandoned, grass growing up through the asphalt of the streets. It's known as the dead zone. In the last hour, I alluded to the idea, the report, that there was a Russian Akula-class submarine cruising around the Gulf of Mexico for several weeks. And its traveling, strategic U.S. waterways, was only confirmed after it left the region. And this is the Washington Free Beacon that reported this. It is only the second time since 2009 that a Russian attack submarine has patrolled so close to U.S. shores. It never happened under the Bush administration. It never happened under the Reagan administration. Not that was ever detected. The stealth underwater incursion in the Gulf took place at the same time Russian strategic bombers made incursions into restricted U.S. airspace near Alaska and California in June and July, and highlights a growing military assertiveness by Moscow, namely Mr. Putin. The submarine patrol also exposed what U.S. officials said were deficiencies in U.S. anti-submarine warfare capabilities. Deficiencies. Well, that's what happens. They're forced to cut back under the Obama administration's plan to reduce defense spending by $487 billion over the next 10 years. By the way, those cuts are not targeted. They happen under a process called sequestration. Those of you that don't know what that means, it's basically a lottery. The cuts take place across the board, which means that even key programs, programs that are critical to the defense of the United States of America, are cut equally with those that are more discretionary. Pentagon and all the defense contractors and all the advisors to the contractors to the Pentagon have no say in what gets cut. Somehow, even though Democrats and Republicans voted against sequestration time and time and time again, every time it was snuck into a bill, it was voted against. Somehow, the leadership, not the rank and file, somehow the leadership snuck sequestration into the bill. And now it has become law. Now, lots of congressmen, lots of senators on both sides of the aisle are dead set against this. The Pentagon fears it. I mean literally fears it. But this $487 billion over the next 10 years, that's about $50 billion a year in cuts, if they're allowed to take place, will not be targeted cuts. They will take place across the board, and you will see programs that are vital to the security of the United States be cut or eliminated. It's sort of like plucking the eyes out of a person. It's just a cut, but without eyes, the person can't see, becomes disabled, can't work, can't take care of themselves. That's what I'm talking about. The Navy is in charge of detecting submarines. Makes sense to me, especially those that sail near U.S. nuclear missile submarines and use undersea sensors and satellites to locate and track them. In fact, the fact that the Akula, an Akula class is a boomer. Those are subs that carry missiles. They can come to almost the surface and launch the missile. Now, normally, an intercontinental ballistic missile will take about 30 to 35 minutes to leave its silo, blast up into space, turn over, and go charging down through the atmosphere, blowing the head apart, the warheads come out, and head off to their individual targets. It takes about 35 minutes for that to take place. If an Akula class that carries ICBMs like this one, armed and ready to go, shows up in the Gulf of Mexico, we're talking 9 minutes. 9 minutes. You can't even get a congressman on the phone in 9 minutes. That is aggressive. The officials who are familiar with reports of the submarine patrol in the Gulf of Mexico said the vessel was a nuclear-powered Akula-class attack submarine, one of Russia's quietest submarines. A Navy spokeswoman declined to comment. You know what she wanted to say? Well, if we'd have had the money to keep patrolling the Gulf of Mexico, it would have never happened. But we don't have any boats in the Gulf of Mexico because all our boats are over in the Suez. All our boats are over in the China Sea. All our boats are out in the Atlantic, in distant lands, fighting undeclared wars. We can't defend our own country. That's what she wanted to say. One official said the Akula operated without being detected for a month. A month. That's a sub that's just partying up and down the Gulf Coast. The Akula was built for one reason and one reason only, and that's to kill U.S. Navy ballistic missile submarines and their crews. It is a very stealthy boat, so it can sneak around and avoid detection and hope to get past any protective screen a boomer might have in place. That's official. That's not me. The U.S. Navy operates a strategic nuclear marine submarine base at Kings Bay, Georgia. The base is home port to 8 missile-firing submarines. 6 of them are equipped with nuclear-tipped missiles and 2 armed with conventional warhead missiles. Sending a nuclear-propelled submarine into the Gulf of Mexico Caribbean region is another manifestation of President Putin demonstrating that Russia is still a player on the world's political military stage, said a naval analyst and a submarine warfare specialist, Norman Polmar. Like the recent deployment of a task force led by a nuclear cruiser into the Caribbean, the Russian Navy provides him with a means of showing the flag that is not possible with Russian air and ground forces. The last time an Akula submarine was known to be close to U.S. shores was 2009, right after Obama was elected president, when 2 Akulas were spotted patrolling off the east coast of the United States. I don't know if you know what that means, but our command and control is on the east coast of the United States. The naval bases at Virginia, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, all of these are the command and control for the United States Department of Defense. Between the Pentagon, Camp Lejeune, Fort Bragg, these are the biggest military bases in the world. Those submarine patrols raised concerns at the time about a new Russian military assertiveness toward the United States. According to the New York Times, which first reported the 2009 Akula submarine activity, the latest submarine incursion into the Gulf further highlights the failure of the Obama administration's reset policy of conciliatory actions designed to develop closer ties with Moscow. Instead of closer ties, Russia under President Vladimir Putin, an ex-KGB intelligence officer who has said he wants to restore elements of Russia's Soviet communist past, has adopted growing hardline policies against the United States and also against rock bands. That's right. Recently, the all-female punk rock group Pussy Riot, for 40 seconds in their performance, criticized President Putin in their song. They were convicted this week of hooliganism and will serve 7 years in a Russian prison. Of the submarine activity, Senator John Cornyn, Republican from Texas, member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said, "It's a confounding situation arising from a lack of leadership in our dealings with Moscow. While the president, small p, is touting our supposed reset in relations with Russia, Vladimir Putin is actively working against American interests, whether it's in Syria or here in our own backyard. The Navy is facing sharp cuts in forces needed to detect and counter such submarine activity, as I told you, under a process called sequestration. If you doubt me, you call your congressman. Go to their website, write them an email and tell them you are against sequestration. Every call, every letter counts. The Obama administration's defense budget proposal in February of this year cuts $1.3 billion from Navy shipbuilding projects, which will result in scrapping plans to build 16 new warships through 2017. The budget also called for cutting plans to buy 10 advanced P-8 anti-submarine warfare jets needed for submarine detection. In June, Russian strategic nuclear bombers and support aircraft conducted a large-scale nuclear bomber exercise in the Arctic. The exercise included simulated strikes on enemy strategic sites that defense officials say likely included notional attacks on U.S. missile defenses in Alaska. Under the terms of the 2010 New START Arms Accord, such exercises require 14-day advance notice of strategic bomber drills and notification after the drills end. Well, guess what? No such notification was given. That's called calling your bluff. A second alarming air incursion took place on July 4th on the West Coast when a Bear H strategic bomber flew into U.S. airspace near California, and it was met by U.S. interceptor jets. That incursion was said to have been a bomber incursion that has not been seen since before the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. It could not be learned, by the way, the next year President Clinton was elected, 1992. At that time, Bush Sr. was president, and we had just invaded Kuwait and kicked Saddam Hussein out, chased them all the way back to Baghdad, and then came home. In 1991, Bush Sr. had a 91% approval rating. 91%. Everybody forgets about that, but that's when CNN was actually born. Oh, they existed before then. But covering that first war, Desert Sword and Desert Shield, is what made CNN famous. Now, they're a fraction of what they used to be because of their politics. But at the time, war was great news. Well, it was during that atmosphere when this bomber incursion occurred in 1991. It occurred again in 2012, July 4th, 2012. Two interceptor jets escorted it out of U.S. airspace. It is also not known why the submarine conducted the operation in the Gulf of Mexico. It was also not known whether it was an Akula 1 or the more advanced Akula 2. We just don't know. Theories among U.S. analysts include the notion that submarine incursion was designed to further signal Russian displeasure at U.S. and NATO plans to deploy missile defenses in Europe. You know, they're not happy about that. They would consider preemptive strikes if those missile defenses are put in place. We, of course, are saying, well, it's to protect against rogue missiles. You know, Iran has the ability to strike Europe. They now have long enough range rockets, and they could put something nasty on there like gas or a biological weapon, or even worse, if they should happen to get a nuclear weapon, although I don't think they would ever waste it on Europe. Mr. Ahmadinejad has one target and one target only. He spoke about it again this week and said that his plan was to completely wipe Israel off the map, return it to Arab control. Well, Russia delivered one of its Akula 2 submarines to India in 2009. The submarine is distinctive for its large tail fin. Brazil's O Estado de São Paulo reported August 2nd that Russia plans to sell Venezuela up to 11 new submarines, including one Akula. Yeah, like Venezuela needs a boomer. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow's military is working to set up naval replenishment facilities in Vietnam and, that's right, Cuba, 90 miles off the coast of Florida, but denied there were plans to base naval forces in those states. Asked if Russia planned a naval base in Cuba, Lavrov said, July 28th of this year, we are not speaking of any bases. The Russian Navy ships serve exercise cruises and training in the same regions. To harbor, resupply, and enable the crew to rest are absolutely natural needs. We have spoken of such opportunities with our Cuban friends. The comment was posted in the Russian Foreign Ministry website. Russian warships and support vessels were sent to Venezuela in 2008, just after the election, to take part in naval exercises and a show of Russian support for the leftist regime of Hugo Chavez. The ships also stopped in Cuba. Russian Deputy Premier Dmitry Rogozin announced in February that Russia was working on a plan to build 10 new attack submarines and 10 new missile submarines through 2030. Well, that beats us. We just scrapped all the ship producing till 2017. Well, as if that is not enough, I mean, that should get you caught up on all the world affairs and what kind of state we're in. You know that we have the most important election in probably two generations coming up. Now, whether you vote one way or another makes no difference to me. I'm just trying to keep you informed so you can make an informed decision. But it is clear this is probably the first time in a long, long time, maybe since before World War II, that we've had such a clear choice. Since the progressives ran in the days of William Cullen Bryant, you remember the movie, don't you? The Wizard of Oz? Yes. The Wizard of Oz, Frank L. Baum, was a political satirist. He wrote the book as a political satire about the election of William Cullen Bryant, which never took place, of course. He ran, but didn't have the courage to stick with it. By the way, Dorothy's slippers, they were silver. That's right. Returning to the silver standard was the way home to Kansas. Not since then have we seen such a clear choice in politics. In recent elections, it's been razor thin. Whether we vote for the guy that's so popular and so careful and so charismatic in front of the people, he's able to get the crowd energized, he's able to move to the center when it's required, move to the left when he wants to, do pretty much whatever he wants to, and then just say, well, that depends on what the word is. Well, we've been through all that. We've seen all that. We've seen these razor-thin, 2,000-vote differences between the winner and the loser. But ideologies are something that kind of get grayed out in politics. Name-calling and mudslinging and, left and right and conservative and liberal. But when Ron Paul started running for president seriously as a Republican, he started a party called the Tea Party. Why did they call themselves the Tea Party? Because in revolutionary times, when we were a colony of Britain, Britain decided to raise the tax on tea. By the way, I think it was 4%. It was pretty high for that day. And so colonialists, rather than pay the tax, boarded the ships in the Boston Harbor and grabbed the crates with the tea on it and dumped it into the harbor. It was in the newspapers called the Boston Tea Party. Well, that is what gave the Tea Party its name in the latter day. We have decided that the taxation, not we, the party has decided that the taxation without representation has gone too far. And so candidates began to be prepared and trained and raised up and funded. And guess what? They are winning elections. They won a lot of elections in 2010. And in 2012, although Ron Paul is not going to be there to lead as president, Ron Paul's efforts did pay off because it started the Arab Spring. It started the people rising up against their governments. It's, and of course, the Arab, Muslim Brotherhood has moved in and seized control like nobody saw that coming. In this country, however, it has meant that the people, the retired people, middle-class people, working people, people that own businesses, are sick and tired of government taking everything that they make and giving it to people who didn't earn it. And so that kind of mentality is rising up inside of our government. And what is it? What it has done normally around Labor Day is when presidential elections really get going. This time we have two clear choices. One choice is that the state can provide everything for you. All you have to do is let the rich put in a large portion of what they make, let the government print money, they'll give it back to the poor and middle class, they will in turn spend it in the economy, of course in targeted areas where the government wants you to spend it, and that will in turn establish a revolving account of economy. The problem is it never works. It didn't work in Greece. It didn't work in Spain. It didn't work in Italy. It doesn't work in any country where it's ever been tried ever in history, and now we're trying it here. But you have the choice. You can elect a government that believes that the state should handle everything. Tell you what to eat, tell you what not to eat, tell you what to wear, what not to wear, tell you what to say and what not to say, tell you where to go and where not to go, and so on and so forth. You have the choice. You can elect that if you want to. The other choice is government doesn't do all that stuff anymore. Government is going to get out of the way. Government's going to get smaller, and we're going to give most of your money back or not even take it from you. We're going to reduce taxes on everybody, and everybody has an equal opportunity. But if you don't make it, well, that's pretty much tough luck. You're going to get a hand up, but you're not going to get a hand out. You're going to have to repay your debts, and you're going to have to reap what you sow. Pretty simple. Two different ideologies. You choose whichever one you think works for you. But I have to warn you, if you think you're one of the professional voter class, that is to say, you go to the poll and you pull the handle for the guy that's going to give you the biggest check, then you're part of the problem, not part of the solution. Just to let you know, the incredible edible egg is being attacked again. No, it's true. The innocuous, sometimes harmless, sometimes excoriated little white egg that goes in the McMuffin, that goes between the slices of bacon, that goes in the rice at the Chinese restaurant, it's under attack again. Just as you thought you were ready to tuck into a nice three-egg omelet again, comforted by the reassuring news that eggs are not so bad for you. Yes, they have cholesterol, but they also have lecithin, which reduces cholesterol. Here comes another study warning that for those over 40, the number of egg yolks, this is no yolk now, consumed per week accelerates the thickening of arteries almost as severely as does cigarette smoking. And if you're eating omelets and smoking, you're in big trouble. So, the study published Tuesday in the journal Atherosclerosis. Oh, yeah, they have their own journal. Athero means blood vessel or artery, and sclerosis means an inflammatory hardening. They measured the carotid wall thickness, a key indicator of heart disease, of 1,231 patients referred to a vascular prevention clinic and asked each to detail a wide range of their health habits, from smoking and exercise to their consumption of egg yolks. Just as smoking is often tallied as pack years, the number of cigarette packs smoked per day, for how many years, egg yolk consumption was tallied as egg yolk years, the number of egg yolks consumed per week times the number of years they were eaten. You people that have farms, you're talking about fertilized eggs. You people that go to grocery stores and buy the pretty white eggs in the styrofoam carton, those are unfertilized eggs. Nothing is said about the difference between the two eggs, but I can tell you because my brother was chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins for more than a decade and led the study in cholesterol. And I can tell you definitively there is a huge difference in the cholesterol content of a fertilized egg compared to an unfertilized egg. The study subjects were typically referred to the clinic after having suffered a clot-induced stroke or a transient ischemic attack, a mini-stroke in which symptoms may disappear quickly but when often presage a more serious stroke to come. So there you have the sample. These aren't just ordinary folks off the street. Hey, come on in here and let us stick a catheter up your carotid. That's the arteries on the side of your neck. And we want to check the thickness of the wall just to see. And they don't grab the people right outside the Waffle House, which I think maybe the study was slightly flawed. Because cholesterol is the most convertible molecule in biochemistry. It is used to build healthy brain cells and fortify conscious thinking, and it's also used as a kind of a gummy glue that can turn into plaque and looks like yellow plastic that's built up on the inside of the arteries. That is completely a function of the genetics of the person eating it. If you have a family history of hardening of the arteries, heart disease, high blood pressure, and I'm going to say not regular high blood pressure, like it's the same pressure in both arms, or you have the same pulse on both sides of your neck. I'm talking about the ones where the pulse is stronger on one side of your body than it is the other side of the body. That's really indicative of hardening of the arteries. They don't typically harden uniformly. No, right-handed people and left-handed people, they favor one side of the body or the other. They use their right hand for a lot of activities like swinging a hammer or pushing a saw or pushing a button. Most people use both their hands kind of in an ambidextrous fashion for typing or for other functions, but they're usually one-handed or the other, and they end up with different circulatory habits, especially if they are prone to hardening of the arteries. So that's a good way to check. If you ever go to the doctor, ask them to take your blood pressure in both arms. Ask them to listen to the pulse in both sides of your neck, especially if you're above 40 years old. It's just a good idea. If you're prone to hardening of the arteries, that's where it's going to show up. However, I'm not going to pick apart the study too much more, even though I am an expert statistician. Smoking tobacco and eating egg yolks increased carotid wall thickness in similar fashion, which is to say the rate of increase accelerated with each stair step up a cigarette smoking or yolk consumption stair. By contrast, for those that did not smoke or who rarely consumed egg yolks, carotid wall thickness increased after 40, but at a slow, steady rate. For those who, and that's if you don't exercise. If you exercise, you get your heart rate up to 132, 136 for extended periods of time. It tends to keep that stuff cleaned out. It's the sedentary lifestyle. No, that's the one where you're sitting on the couch watching football, not playing football. Sedentary lifestyle. It's even worse. For those whose consumption of whole eggs was in the highest 20%, the narrowing of the carotid artery was on average about two-thirds of that of the study's heaviest smokers. So, if you have a choice, eggs, cigarettes, choose eggs, okay? Don't choose cigarettes. We believe our study makes it imperative to reassess the role of egg yolks and dietary cholesterol in general, as a risk factor for coronary heart disease, and you can always switch over to egg beaters. You get a little bit of yolk, you get a whole lot of albumin, and that is egg beaters, and they're dehydrated. We get dehydrated eggs at Boy Scout camp all the time, and once you get used to them, they're awesome. Come on. You're not going to get a sunny side egg, but you can't tell the difference. And almost nobody can mess them up. I mean, come on. We're talking about Boy Scout camp cooks here, and the eggs are great. So you got a choice. If you're over 40, cut back to a dozen egg yolks a month or less. You'll be fine. I have some more information that Jim has sent me, and this is on power grid tampering. Will end an era. There's an experiment going on where they're varying the frequency of different portions of the grid. Well, those of you that know the power distribution business, that's why you tune into this program, because we have such excellent knowledge here. You will know that the frequency of the grid is absolutely irrefutable. It is 60 cycles per second. I don't mean 60. I mean 60.001 cycles per second. You cannot have different portions of the grid at different frequencies, because what happens is the frequencies become destructively interfering with one another, and you can't send 61 hertz electricity from the southeast to 59 hertz electricity in the northwest. The two will collide, and you end up with heat, and you end up with power loss. The frequency is absolutely controlled, not to mention the huge mass of the generators that sit in hydroelectric plants and nuclear power plants and coal-fired plants. Once those rotors get up to speed, they are very carefully controlled. That's a whole lot of tonnage that has to be kept at a very, very consistent frequency. Now, that being said, they generate the same frequency in three different phases. Each phase is 120 degrees out from the other. And what this does is it gives you a three-phase, that's why you see three wires on the power lines, folks. Two of those wires are picked off and sent to a transformer on the pole outside your house or in the lawn in your neighborhood. Two of those phases are delivered as 220 volts to your house. So one phase operates half the 110-volt circuits in your house. The other phase runs the other half. And combined, they run your stove, your hot water heater, and your air conditioner. That's the way it works. Every single appliance that you have, from your clock to your washer or your dryer, operates off that 60 hertz. It can run off 50 hertz, but not very efficiently. It needs 60 hertz. Now, that being said, those motors all put what's called back EMF, electromotive force, back onto the line. For a house, it might have an average of two or three motors in it. You know, the blower on your air conditioner, the motor in your washer, the motor in your dryer. That's about it. For a factory, that might have 200 or 300 or even 2,000 or 3,000 motors operating. That's a lot of back EMF. What they do is they put power factor correction capacitors into the switchgear, which takes that back EMF and absorbs it. If your power factor drops below 90%, you're going to be fined by the power company. Those fines are expensive, and they're non-value added. Plus, they tend to generate a lot of heat in your system. So the idea is to keep your power factor above 95%, hopefully 96 or 97%. You're making money. The power company is getting a fair dollar back, and they don't have to worry about the power factor being reduced. So with all of that protective energy and all that protective gear in place, we cannot have the power company, well, not actually the power company. This is allegedly being run by an organization that is, it's been around for a long time, and it's very huge, and it is an agency. And it is called, it has kind of a long name, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. Okay, they manage all of the power stations in the country, and they make sure that those frequencies are absolutely rock solid. Now, the only way that you could give one side a different frequency than another is if you separate those grids from one another. And that means that you're basically taking apart the national power grid. That was Jim's main point. So I might cover that a little bit next week. It's hard to say. Don't forget we have Noel Sharkey coming on next week. He is the artificial intelligence and robotics specialist from Sheffield University. We're going to talk about this slippery slope of drone wars. Those of you that are listening to this as an archive, you want to listen to that one live. Tell your friends. We'll be back next week on X Squared Radio. We love you. See you next week.
Many times.